On February 3, 1959, a small, single-engine, four-passenger airplane took off from a remote field in rural Iowa. It was after midnight, it was snowing, it was windy, and moments later, the airborne plane rolled over and flew into the ground at approximately 170 miles per hour. This is about 275 kilometers per hour. The 21-year-old pilot and the three passengers were killed on impact. The passengers were ejected and found in the snow-covered field the next day. The pilot had remained strapped into the ball of twisted metal. The injuries to all four were horrific. The post-crash investigation would reveal that not only the pilot, but the flying service that employed him were only rated to fly VFR. That's visual flight rules. This basically required that the pilot be able to see where he was going. Yet he was blinded by the dark and the snow nearly from the moment the wheels left the tarmac. This small crash on a cold winter night would reverberate throughout history, not only to this day, but likely until the end of time. But why? Did the pilot make errors? Was the young pilot in over his head? Was he even qualified? Could the plane's instruments be blamed? Certainly, all the ingredients were there for a crash caused by the weather. So what about the weather briefing? Did the pilot know about the weather? All pilots are required by law to have a weather briefing before departure. So was the weather briefing adequate, given that the conditions included snow, low ceilings, and wind? And then there's this. Was there a gunshot on board that took the plane down? And why, 56 years after this crash in 2015, why was there a request to the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, to reopen the investigation? And as if it couldn't get any more intriguing or mysterious, why was there an exhumation of the body of one of the passengers decades after the crash? And lastly, who? Who was on board this fated flight that made this crash stand out as one that was responsible for the writing of books and songs, the production of movies, and the erection of monuments? Why was this crash one of the most emotional aviation crashes in the history of music? And why will this crash continue to be remembered throughout history, perhaps forever? And might someday this investigation be opened again? This is Radar Contact Lost, the podcast. I'm your host, Dave Gorham. I'm a retired meteorologist with a career in the United States Air Force, commercial and broadcast weather forecasting, with a specialty of aviation meteorology. I've provided weather support to Air Force One and to Marine One. I've briefed military and corporate flight crews. I've been both a television and radio broadcast meteorologist and have spent a large part of my career providing commercial weather support to clients in all parts of the world. I've created this podcast series to bring you interesting but tragic stories of airplane crashes that are either caused by the weather or when the weather is a contributing factor to the crash. Today's episode, When a Snowy Crash Silenced the Voices of Early Rock and Roll, is the tragic tale of a chartered plane that crashed shortly after takeoff on one dark, snowy night in Iowa in 1959. In this episode, the Radar Contact Lost team will examine what happened. I'll start with the weather, because weather was at the heart of this crash. At least weather was the easy issue to blame, but there were other issues. Issues that, on their own, might have caused the plane to crash even without the complicating factor of snow, wind, and darkness. I'll also look at the pilot. As I mentioned earlier, he was just 21 years old. Why was he at the controls? I mentioned that he was only VFR rated, not IFR. Again, why was he at the controls? I'll also take a look at the airline, a flying service, as well as shed some light on one of the somewhat unknown theories of why this plane crashed. That there was a gunshot on the plane that killed the pilot and led to the confusion in the cockpit that resulted in the crash. And of course, I'll tell the story of the passengers on board, who they were, who they were about to become, and why it was these three passengers who will be remembered not only on this day, 65 years later, but perhaps until the end of time. by the way, this is the first anniversary edition of Radar Contact Lost, the podcast. I'm publishing this episode on the very day of the crash 65 years ago, February 3rd, 1959. Today is February 3rd, 2024. This flight was a chartered flight of a 1949 Beechcraft Bonanza, owned by the Dwyer Flying Service, based at the Mason City Municipal Airport in Mason City, Iowa, in the United States. This airplane was a four-passenger, single-engine, V-tailed airplane that has the distinction today of being in production longer than any other aircraft in history. The first flight of a Bonanza took place in 1945, then regular production began in 1947, and the Bonanza is still being produced today. There have been more than 17,000 Beechcraft Bonanzas produced. We'll talk more about this plane in a little bit. It's an interesting plane, but not one without an unflattering reputation. The charter of the Bonanza had come about, not unlike the crash itself, as a result of the weather, among other reasons. Primarily, it was the low ceilings, restricted visibility, the snow, the wind, plus it was dark. But before I get into the charter and then the crash, I need to start at the beginning. Why was there a need or a desire for this charter, and who exactly was on board? If you haven't figured it out by now, the crash I'm referring to is the crash that took the lives of three musicians, as well as the pilot. Charles Hardin Holley, professionally known as Buddy Holly, Richard Stephen Valenzuela, professionally known as Richie Valens, and Giles Perry Richardson, who went by JP to his friends, but was known professionally as the Big Bopper. These three men, the leaders of their respective bands, were on the Bonanza to fly to their next concert, flying from northern Iowa to Moorhead, Minnesota, a small town on the border of Minnesota and North Dakota in the north-central United States. The flight was between two shows on the Winter Dance Party Tour of 1959. One show had finished just hours before the crash, and the next show would take place in the coming hours. Wait a second, these two towns by road are 365 miles apart. So they had one show in Iowa, finished the show, drove to the airport, got on the plane around midnight, and then they were going to fly to the next town and do the next show later that same day? Yes. And okay, maybe that's not too unusual. Especially today with modern interstate highways, vehicles, and air travel. Especially on the charter side with private planes that bypass many of the delays and headaches of commercial flying. Though charter and executive flying in 1959 was perhaps not in its infancy, it wasn't quite clockwork either. Still, it was better than traveling by road in the mid-20th century. One of my previous employers in executive aviation support, Universal Weather and Aviation, had its beginnings in 1959, the same year as this crash. Universal played a large part in helping executive aviation become more streamlined and efficient. But a local or grassroots approach to executive transport had begun years earlier with fixed-based operators, or FBOs. These airport gas stations, if you will, provided charter and other aviation services from local airports going back to the 1920s. Charter service in those days, especially at rural airfields, wasn't much more than a pilot waiting around hoping a passenger would show up. In 1959, as commercial air service dawned into the golden age of jet travel, charters and private aviation were making progress by providing personal, tailored, and off-schedule service to those who could afford it. However, it was still quite common for entertainers and sports teams and others to travel the country by bus or even train from city to city. It was rare in those days for even large music tours that bounced from city to city to rely on air travel. And actually, that still holds true today to a large degree. And so it was that Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and the Big Bopper, and their bandmates, found themselves on a bus as they traveled with the Winter Dance Party Tour of 1959. Or, as members of the tour would call it, the Tour from Hell. It was the extremely bad organization of this tour, along with the weather, that would eventually lead the three rock and rollers to the airport for their date with Destiny. Imagine, you're a musician in 1959 on this tour. The tour began 11 days earlier in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and it was to be 24 days in total. There was a show every night, there were no days off, and the venues were often hundreds of miles apart. The tour zigzagged and meandered through Wisconsin, Iowa, and Minnesota. The tour often passed through cities where they had previously played two or three times. It was as if the tour organizers just threw darts at a map of the three states in the central United States and planned the tour by where the random darts stuck in the wall. Luxury bus travel may have been a thing in 1959, but it was far from that on this tour. The whole tour squeezed in on one bus, and it broke down over and over. One bus would break down, so they'd call in the next, and then that one would break down. By the time of the crash, not quite halfway through the tour, they had gone through five different buses. And the buses were pretty bad. They were primarily cast-off school buses, they were cramped and drafty, and heat was in short supply. They were made for kids traveling to school, not for adults traveling hundreds of miles at a time. The band members were not only sitting elbow to elbow, but there was no crew, no roadies to do the loading and unloading and setup. The musicians did it all. And if you're thinking, wow, three bands squeezed into one school bus, well, there was actually only one band on board, and that was Buddy Holly's band. They played not only for Buddy, but for the other headliners on the tour as well. By the end of the first week, many on the bus were sick with colds and flu, including Richardson and Valens. At the start of the second week, Buddy Holly's drummer, a man named Carl Bunch, had to drop off the tour because, of all things, his feet had become frostbitten. With the hundreds of rural miles between the shows, the low morale and sickness on the bus, and the loss of his drummer from frostbite, Buddy had had enough. He decided to escape the misery of the tour bus and charter an airplane for himself and two other members of the tour. This luxury would allow him to jump ahead of the bus and catch up on some rest. As chance would have it, those two other members never even ended up on the plane. One, Tommy Alsup, he lost his seat to Richie Valens to a coin toss. As he was climbing aboard the plane, Valens was heard to say, "Wow, I've never won anything before." The other seat was given up by eventual superstar Waylon Jennings. In a friendly gesture to his friend, Jennings conceded his seat to the Big Bopper, who was feeling poorly with the flu. It's not a far stretch to imagine that if the tour had been better organized, had there been fewer miles between the shows, had the venues been planned more logically, had there been some recuperation time built into the schedule every few days, had the buses been of better quality, less drafty and with better heating, perhaps if the tour began in March or April when it was warmer, had these generally miserable conditions not occurred, or had not been inevitable, really, then perhaps Buddy would have never chartered the airplane in the first place. He and the two others would have remained on the bus with everybody else. Those specific circumstances were never mentioned in the accident report by the CAB. It seems like a fair assumption, though, to me. Let's talk about the weather, because the CAB, the Civil Aeronautics Board, which was the precursor to the National Transportation Safety Board in the United States, the CAB summarized the cause of this crash as, quote, "following loss of control in poor weather at night," unquote. The weather at the time, according to the report, included a ceiling of 3,000 feet AMSL, or above mean sea level. 3,000 feet is about 370 meters. The visibility was 6 miles, or 10 kilometers, in light snow, and the winds were blowing at 20 to 30 miles per hour, or about 9 to 13 meters per second. No wind direction was noted in the report. However, given that there was a cold front that extended from northern Minnesota southwestward into Nebraska, the winds were likely favoring a southerly or southwesterly direction. The temperature was 20 degrees, that's about minus 6 Celsius. And VFR, those conditions are VFR, visual flight rules. One report I read said that the skies were clear at the time, but with blowing snow. The surface analysis from near the time of the crash showed a broad area of light to moderate snow occurring from southern Kansas northward into South Dakota and North Dakota and into central Minnesota. When conditions are VFR, it means that even at night, the pilot doesn't need instruments to legally fly his airplane. At the same time, the destination airport was also VFR. However, there was heavier snow in the area, as well as lower ceilings and visibility, and a cold front was moving in from the west. And I want to emphasize that this was not a surprise snowstorm that took the Bonanza pilot by surprise. This was a big winter storm that had been moving across the plains and was well advertised. I took a look at the weather conditions from the hour before the flight, and I plotted the location of the cold front. From their departure point in Mason City, Iowa, the front was about 200 miles to the west-northwest. However, the plane's destination was northwest of Mason City, so their flight would take them directly into the path of the approaching cold front, including the heaviest snow, the lowest ceilings, and the thickest clouds. A prudent pilot, I think, at that point, armed with that weather information, would keep the plane and his passengers on the ground. Yet we know that was not the case. About an hour before the plane took off, there was a flash advisory issued by the National Weather Bureau that contained the following information. Quote, "A band of snow about 100 miles wide from extreme northwestern Minnesota, northern North Dakota, through Bismarck, North Dakota, and south-southwestward through Black Hills, South Dakota, with visibility generally 2 miles in snow. The area or band of snow is moving southeastward at about 25 knots. Cold front from vicinity Winnipeg, Canada, through Minot and Williston, North Dakota, moving southeastward at 25 to 30 knots, with surface winds following cold front northwest at 25 knots, with gusts to 45 knots, unquote. The Weather Bureau in those days, the National Weather Service today, not really known for their dramatic writing styles. But as described, this band of snow did not include Mason City and the departure airport. However, the leading edge of the heavy snow was only about 125 miles to the west and getting 30 to 35 miles closer with each passing hour. It was already lightly snowing at the airport, but the heavier snow was on its way. The first advisory was followed by a second advisory, this time about 45 minutes before takeoff. It stated that over the eastern half of Kansas, ceilings are locally below 1,000 feet, with visibilities of locally 2 miles or less in freezing drizzle, light snow, and fog. It continued, and from any pilot's perspective, became even more ominous. It said, quote, "Moderate to locally heavy icing areas of freezing drizzle and locally moderate icing in clouds below 10,000 feet over eastern portions of Nebraska, Kansas, northwest Missouri, and most of Iowa," unquote. This included both the arrival and destination airports, as well as the entire route of flight. This area, by the way, is the north-central United States, and all of these states that I've mentioned border one another. If you're not from the United States, then imagine these states as a cluster, and we'll work our way around from the bottom, going clockwise starting with Iowa, then it's westward over to Nebraska, northward up to South Dakota and North Dakota, then eastward over to Minnesota, and back down southward again to where we started in Iowa. If you're a pilot, it's important to know the weather in all of these states, but especially if you're located in Iowa or Minnesota, because the weather typically moves from west to east. So what's happening in Nebraska or South Dakota will soon move into Iowa and Minnesota. I think most pilots have the sense to be concerned about the weather when they're not flying in the days, especially the hours leading up to their next flight. It only makes sense to stay abreast of what's going on or what might be changing or when it might be changing. Most pilots have a basic understanding of the clouds and the sky and how they indicate changing weather patterns that are afoot. And the pilot here did have a handle on the weather. At least he had the information to expect the weather could be an issue. In the preceding 8 hours, he checked in with flight services 3 times. This would have been a phone call, I'm sure. He could make that from home or from a restaurant perhaps where he was having dinner. He was informed that the route was VFR with ceilings of 4,200 feet or almost 1,300 meters. The visibility was 10 miles or 16 kilometers. On the face of it, this was not concerning. But even though this may very well have been the case 8 or even 5 hours before the flight, this was a rapidly changing dynamic situation. It was reported that he was not told about the approaching band of snow, and he did not receive either of the flash advisories, neither the one an hour and a half before the flight or the one 45 minutes before the flight. Mr. Dwyer, the flying service owner, later said that no mention of either of the two advisories were brought to the attention of the pilot or to Mr. Dwyer himself. The post-crash report from the CAB stated that neither of the flight service personnel could recall providing the weather advisories to the pilot. It's hard for me to wrap my head around the decision by this pilot to roll the plane out of the hangar and take off without the most current weather information. It would have been a major failure for the weather briefer to not communicate these winter weather advisories, but the pilot, as well as the flying service, have the responsibility to obtain all of the available weather information and interpret it correctly. The fact that it was midnight in rural Iowa in 1959, with a winter storm approaching, may have played a role in this. The pilot should have been checking the weather as he was taxiing out to the runway. As an aviation meteorologist, it would be hard for me to not consider severe icing conditions along this route, given the conditions. I mean, if not here, then when? This is an approaching winter storm with a cold front that included wind, snow, ice, rain, drizzle, and clouds. I mean, come on. As Bob Dylan once said, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. With conditions like these, the prudent pilot should assume the weather will be an issue and plan accordingly. However, as I've mentioned in previous podcasts, specifically how different weather affected aircraft was not well known in those days. Icing, turbulence, downdrafts, and microbursts, it wasn't until the 1980s and 90s that these concepts began to gel as new technology like Doppler radar proved out the science. I checked in with Captain Michelle, and she said that airlines today have different regulations, but most prohibit their pilots from flying into areas of severe icing. However, even if I, as an aviation meteorologist, brief a pilot of severe icing conditions, it's not my place to prohibit the flight. The captain of the aircraft is the pilot in command, the PIC. It's the PIC who is responsible for all decisions related to the flight. Even air traffic controllers, who you would think have ultimate authority, have to defer to the PIC and advise the PIC to, quote, proceed at your own risk, unquote. Okay, so we've talked about the weather, and I think we can agree it was pretty bad. And I think this pilot had at least a clue that he was setting off into troubling conditions. How could he not? We'll talk about the pilot in a few minutes, but we should talk about the airplane first. Of course, there are planes made for this kind of duty, so surely this professional pilot, flying passengers who had hired him through a professional flying service at the airport, would use the most advanced aircraft available for this job. That would make sense, but that's not what happened. Actually, I don't know what other aircraft were available. Perhaps there weren't any, and the Bonanza was the only choice. So let's take a look at the Beechcraft Bonanza. As I mentioned, the first of these small planes took to the skies in 1945 and reached production in 1947. This particular plane was built in 1949, so it was 10 years old at the time of this crash. And I mentioned earlier that the Bonanza has earned the distinction of being the most continuously produced aircraft of all time, with more than 17,000 Bonanzas rolling off the assembly line in Wichita, Kansas. It's a sophisticated plane with retractable landing gear. It's reliable, efficient, comfortable, fun to fly, and it has a reputation as a speedster. But it's not cheap to maintain, and its design can make it unforgiving to inexperienced pilots. And it's not built for ice. You'd likely recognize this plane flying overhead or seeing it at the airport, as it has a very distinctive V-shaped tail. This V-tail combines the attributes of the horizontal stabilizer and elevators with the vertical stabilizer and rudder into what is called the rudder-vator. This allowed the plane to be a good handler with a light touch at the controls, but it also required an attentive pilot, as the V-tail could quickly allow loss of control if the plane was in a roll. One article I read stated, quote, "A VFR pilot in clouds was almost auto-dead," unquote. The same article from airfaxjournal.com went on to say, "Not much of early Bonanza flying was IFR. It could be done, but the system was pretty crude in the years after the war." Though this crash was in 1959, the plane itself was built just a few years after World War II. As great as the Bonanza was, and is, it had the nickname of the Doctor Killer. It's less of a problem today, but it was a big step up to a Bonanza, still is, as most pilots learn on smaller and lighter aircraft. So there was a lot to learn. Sometimes that step up was too big, and some lesser trained and lesser experienced pilots crashed. Some of those pilots were fair weather or casual pilots and would not approach the Bonanza with the respect it deserved. As it turned out, many of these pilots were doctors. Lots of money to own such a machine, but perhaps not the time or the desire to learn to fly it proficiently. Other professionals fell into this category too, lawyers and movie stars, for example. And it wasn't just the Bonanza. Other planes like the Cessna 310 were a big step up from the smaller aircraft these pilots learned on, and the pilots were sometimes caught out and crashed. It's unfortunate, but many pilots made the move to the new aircraft with an attitude of, "Hey, no sweat, I got this." Starting in 1968, some Bonanza versions were stretched to 6 passengers. But whether it was a 4-passenger or a 6-passenger, the inside was cramped, especially for 4 men. Though I read a few reports that said the interior was comfy for 4 with a spacious baggage compartment, I guess it comes down to your size and your preference for personal space. I suppose, too, the good news for the flight in 1959 is that the passengers were able to leave most of their luggage on the tour bus, so they were likely traveling pretty light. As for the size of the men on the Bonanza, Buddy Holly was pretty lanky, if not downright skinny, at about 6 feet tall and 145 pounds. I'm assuming one doesn't get a nickname like the Big Bopper because he was a lightweight like Holly. Waylon Jennings has said that Richardson was about 300 pounds and had trouble sitting on the bus. That said, the plane was built to haul people and luggage, and there was nothing in the crash report that indicated the plane was overloaded. For what it was and what it was designed to do, the Bonanza was and is a good plane. The simple fact that it's been in production for almost 80 years tells us that Beechcraft got the Bonanza formula right from the beginning. But they did not design it to fly in ice and snow. Therefore, a pilot has to be aware of what the tools at his or her disposal are capable of. Without de-icing equipment, the Bonanza should have stayed in the hangar that night in Iowa. In fact, the winter storm that was blowing in should have kept all the planes in the hangar that night, even the ones with de-icing equipment. We've talked about icing on several of the Radar Contact Lost podcast episodes before, including the difference between anti-icing and de-icing, but we can keep that conversation short for this episode because there wasn't any of that equipment on board, and the plane was not de-iced or sprayed with an anti-icing fluid before its departure. Again, we take this stuff for granted today, but it was far from that 65 years ago. And a few moments ago I mentioned the V-tail. It's been noted that one of its notable design flaws is its failure in icing conditions. I suggested a moment ago, on a night like this, that the pilot likely rolled out the most sophisticated aircraft he had at his disposal, but actually, I don't know what he had available. Maybe the Bonanza was the only one. Maybe better-suited aircraft were down for maintenance. Maybe he preferred the sporty Bonanza. Maybe he knew his special passengers would enjoy the Bonanza's sports car-like handling. I don't know, but the Bonanza was not the right tool for this job. Which leads us to the pilot and his decision-making abilities. To be blunt, he made some very bad decisions. The first bad decision was choosing the Bonanza. But as I just mentioned, maybe he didn't have a choice. Therefore, the next bad decision was not so much choosing the Bonanza, but using the Bonanza. To fully understand this decision, we have to take a closer look at the pilot, especially his experience and his familiarity with the Bonanza, his tool of choice as it was that night. The CAB report, again, that was the NTSB of its day, the Civil Aeronautics Board, they devoted only two paragraphs of their 9-page report to the pilot, 21-year-old Roger Peterson. I was shocked by his young age, but he was a regular pilot for the Dwyer Flying Service and even a flight instructor. However, he was not IFR rated. He had only passed his oral instrument exam, and he had failed the check ride test for his instrument rating 9 months earlier. He had been flying for 5 years, so that means he started flying as a 16-year-old. He had a total of 711 flying hours, and 128 of those were in the Bonanza. 128. Remember that number. Today, I think we'd call him a pilot nerd or an airplane nerd. It seems like he had been building his young life and career around flying and around airplanes. As I get older in years, I can't help but wonder how I made it to this age. Mostly, I wonder about the decisions I made as a teenager and as a young adult. And I'm sure many of you feel the same way. Sometimes, maybe many times, we just don't know what we don't know. On this fateful night in Iowa, I don't think young Mr. Peterson knew how bad it was going to be or felt that he could handle whatever the storm threw at him. Yet, we can't call that youthful innocence when he is the PIC, the pilot in command of an airplane carrying 3 passengers. Just like how in the Radar Contact Lost episode about the Colgan Air Flight 3407 disaster, we cannot call what those pilots did rookie mistakes, because as professional pilots who are responsible for the lives of others, we don't expect rookie mistakes and youthful innocence inside the cockpit. Like the CAB report, I don't have much else to say about this pilot. He was young, and he made the decision to crash his airplane before he ever took off. By now, I think most of the regular listeners of Radar Contact Lost are familiar with Captain Michelle. She's contributed to nearly every episode, and I enjoy her friendship. She was an Air Force fighter pilot and an instructor before moving on to her career with FedEx, where she retired as the senior female captain a few years ago. But she'll admit that her experience with small planes is limited. She has her single engine rating, but mentioned that she doesn't have that much time in small planes, just about 180 hours. That number hit me as significant. I'm sure she's quantifying those hours as insignificant because she has so many thousands of hours in the comparatively monstrous cargo jets of FedEx. But that 180 hours struck a chord with me because, remember, the pilot of our story here, Roger Peterson, had just 128 hours in the Bonanza. Captain Michelle looked at the circumstances of this flight and said that she would be, quote, hesitant to fly into that weather with that airplane, unquote. That comes from the perspective of decades of experience flying some of the most sophisticated aircraft on the planet. For another perspective, I wanted to check in with some of my other pilot friends. I have breakfast with these guys most Friday mornings, and we ride motorcycles together. Len and Mike have been flying small planes, single and multi-engine, for decades. Len has some commercial experience. Both Len and Mike, oddly enough, given our story here, have many hours of experience in Bonanzas. Todd's experience is less, and he has no Bonanza experience, but he is still a worthy source for opinions in aviation, so I explained the conditions of this crash to my friends. The weather, the airplane, and the pilot. All three almost unanimously said, "That's a hard no." Len said that one of the things that would be a concern for him is the weight and balance of the airplane. Bonanzas, both four-seaters and the six-seaters, and especially those with the V tail, could be very sensitive to a tail-heavy attitude. Based on the crash evidence, there is no way to determine how the plane was loaded, but Len mentioned that when he was flying the six-seater Bonanza, he was concerned enough about the balance that he would put luggage in the two rear seats rather than in the luggage compartment at the rear of the airplane. This allowed him to keep the weight as far forward as possible. Len also mentioned something that could affect any pilot anytime in any aircraft: the time it took for the pilot's eyes to adjust to the darkness of flight after the bright lights of the airport. This was the very situation that was the focus of the helicopter crash that killed Texas guitarist Stevie Ray Vaughan in 1990. The non-IFR-rated helicopter pilot became disoriented in the few moments it took for his eyes to adjust to the darkness following the bright lights of the parking lot below where he had just lifted off from. Instrument-rated pilots will rely on their instruments to keep the aircraft stable and flying properly, but because this helicopter pilot was not trained to rely on the instruments of the helicopter, he became disoriented and flew into a mountainside, killing all the passengers on board as well as himself. Here we are now, 34 years after that crash, wondering the same thing as with the Bonanza crash. What could have been had Stevie Ray not been killed at such a young age? Check out episode 9 of Radar Contact Lost for the full story on the Stevie Ray Vaughan helicopter crash. My friend Mike was quite blunt, so I won't use the exact words he used, but his point was that the pilot never should have rolled the Bonanza out of the hangar. A small plane like this, not certified for ice, should not set off into known icing conditions. He added that the pilot should rely on icing equipment only for an emergency and then exit the area of icing immediately. It should not be used for departing an airfield and flying into icing conditions that would likely last for the entire flight. And that's only if the small airplane has some de-icing equipment on board. The Bonanza of this crash had none. Mike was emphatic. The pilot should have stayed on the ground. Todd's first thought was not the airplane, but the weather. He said that even though the departure and arrival airports were VFR at the time of departure, the simple fact that with the already questionable weather conditions and that the forecast called for worsening conditions, that alone would have kept him on the ground. Todd reminded me that small airplanes without de-icing equipment don't typically have spotlights for the wings, meaning it would be impossible for the pilot of a Bonanza at night to see any accumulating ice on the wings. Another reason, he said, that he would not set off into the dark, snowy night. All three of these small airplane pilots would have kept their airplanes in the hangar. Of course, it wasn't that simple for Roger Peterson. He had paying customers that had to get to their destinations. And these weren't just any passengers, they were famous rock and roll stars. Let's take a look at this crash from the perspective of the pilot. We already know what he did, but is it as simple as making the tragic decision to take off? Maybe we could call this post-crash perspective an off-ramp, a term that's been in the news a lot here in the United States of late. But this off-ramp might mean that we don't have to lay the entirety of this disastrous, fatal, and unnecessary accident on the shoulders of our 21-year-old pilot. Maybe there's a way to understand how he got in over his head without any way to dig himself out. This off-ramp would come in the form of the instrument that indicates the horizon to the pilot. This instrument helps pilots understand the attitude of the aircraft. It's called the attitude indicator, or the artificial horizon. I think even non-pilots know what this is. We've seen it in countless movies and TV shows. In the cockpit, it sits front and center, so the pilot has an unobstructed view of the instrument that superimposes an aircraft-like image in front of or over an artificial horizon. Nose up, nose down, wings rolling left or right, the instrument makes it obvious to the pilot what is happening to the airplane. Pitch, roll, yaw. No matter if the pilot can see the actual horizon outside the window or not. When a pilot is flying IFR, that is, in clouds or low visibility, the attitude indicator is the primary instrument for orienting the aircraft to the Earth. In the early days of the Bonanza, the aircraft used a gyro-based attitude indicator called the Sperry F3. Oddly, but as a necessity of its internal mechanics, the F3 displayed the horizon upside down, or reversed from normal, and most importantly, reversed from the aircraft Peterson was accustomed to flying. In the panicked life-or-death situation that was the cockpit of the Bonanza in the moments before the crash, it's easy to imagine that the inexperienced pilot could have become confused with the reversed image. Spatial disorientation is what this confusion is called. The pilot wouldn't know what was up, what was down, or if he was spinning this way or that way. Here's another off-ramp that might give the pilot an out. And this would be another problem with the instruments, this time not related to the internal mechanics, but the external wind. As I mentioned, a winter storm was underway and there was a cold front approaching. Naturally, the winds were strong and gusty. The latest weather observation from the departure airport reported winds of 20 to 30 miles per hour. These winds could, or would, likely cause the rate of climb indicator and the turn and bank indicator to fluctuate enough that it could have caused confusion to the pilot in the very moments when he needed absolute clarity. One more thing that my pilot buddy Len reminded me of. The snow and ice could have caused the pitot tube to clog. The pitot tube measures the airplane's speed, and speed is everything when trying to keep a plane in the air. With the snow already falling, and likely getting heavier in the moments after departure, it's possible the pitot tube became clogged, making it impossible for the pilot to know a critical component of flying his aircraft. The CAB report did not mention this possibility. Can we allow a 21-year-old pilot a little slack or a little bit of understanding when it comes to misreading wonky or fluctuating instruments? Or if a pilot gets into a plane without a full understanding of the limitations or peculiarities of its instruments? Well, if the pilot doesn't crash, maybe. If he or she crashes and kills only himself or herself, maybe. We can shake our heads and wonder, what were they thinking? But the moment other people are hurt or killed at the hands of a professional who we have placed our trust in, then no, absolutely no. We cannot offer them an off-ramp. I'll mention something else here. The 21-year-old pilot may have simply been fan-struck and willing to do anything for the group of rock and roll royalty. And if not do anything, then at least not disappoint them. Can you imagine being in Roger's shoes as he was having to tell these three stars that he couldn't help them? In my day, that would be like Led Zeppelin walking into the airport and relying on me to help them. How could I not be their savior? You say you want bagels? It's midnight. We're in Iowa. Well, all right. Yeah, absolutely. I'll be right back. I'm sure the three musicians leaned heavily on the impressionable young pilot to get them to their next show, which was just hours away. The pilot, likely filled with thoughts of being the hero for these men, walked out to the airplane, turned over the engine, and hoped for the best. I'm sure lots of pilots have felt the pressure to take off when they know it's likely best to stay on the ground. That's an unfortunate scenario, and we know how it ended in this case. But it's a good segue to talk about just who these three passengers were. First, Buddy Holly. He was the biggest star that night at the airport, and he was one of the biggest stars of the emerging rock and roll scene. His song, That'll Be the Day, had been released in 1957 and reached the top of the US charts. A year before the crash, he released his hit Rave On, and that same month appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show for the second time. In the months before the crash, he had been touring and recording, even taking some acting lessons. He turned down a third appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show because he said he didn't need it. He'd gotten married just 6 months before the crash, and he became one of those guys whose manager insisted he hide his wife and marriage so as not to disappoint the adoring female fans. Elvis, I believe, had to do the same thing. It became known later that his wife was in the early weeks of pregnancy at the time of the crash. She later lost the baby to a miscarriage when she learned of the crash. Even after his death, awards and recognitions came in the decades following, including one somewhat recently in 2017 with the groundbreaking of the Buddy Holly Performing Arts Center in Lubbock, Texas, his hometown. Those who claim Buddy Holly as an influence are many, including the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Elton John, Bobby V, who replaced Buddy on the Winter Dance Party tour after the plane crash, The Clash, Bruce Springsteen as well. In fact, Bruce Springsteen has said that he plays Buddy Holly every night before he goes on stage. He said, "That keeps me honest." Holly was credited with developing the quintessential rock quartet, drums, bass, and two guitars, as well as being the model for future singer-songwriters, as Holly's band was the first to do it all, the writing, the singing, the playing of all the instruments, something I had always attributed to the Beatles before I began researching this story. The Big Bopper, aka J.P. Richardson, had released Chantilly Lace the year before, and then the tune called The Big Bopper's Wedding shortly after that. Both of these songs were getting top 40 airplay at the time of the crash. Like Holly, he has been memorialized in books, film, and music, as well as statues and monuments. He's been recognized by the Iowa Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the Rockabilly Hall of Fame as well. Before all of his national fame, there was local fame as a DJ at a hometown radio station in Beaumont, Texas. He earned his famous nickname by promoting a new dance called the Bop. In college, the Big Bopper studied pre-law. Richie Valens was just 17 at the time of this crash, but had already been on Dick Clark's American Bandstand, and his big hit, La Bamba, had been released in 1958. His double A-side record, the one with La Bamba and Donna, was released just a few months before the crash and had already sold 1 million copies. He was the first crossover artist to bring Chicano rock and Latin rock to a broader audience as he successfully crossed over into mainstream rock and roll, while inspiring many along the way. He's counted as an influence by Los Lonely Boys, Los Lobos, Carlos Santana, The Beach Boys, Jimi Hendrix, Led Zeppelin, and others. If you're curious about the Led Zeppelin connection, do a little Googling on the song Oh My Head by Richie Valens and how it morphed into the song Boogie with Stu on the Led Zeppelin album Physical Graffiti, one of my favorites. Boogie with Stu is traced back to Valens and even to Little Richard before that. And I said Valens was just 17 at the time of this crash, but really everybody on the plane was a kid. Buddy Holly was 22, the Big Bopper was 28, and the pilot, Roger Peterson, as we know, was 21. None of the four on the plane had children, though, as I mentioned, Holly's wife was in the early stages of an unsuccessful pregnancy, while Richardson's wife gave birth to a son 2 months after the crash. What a tragedy for everybody involved. And that leaves us with the cliche, what could have been? Buddy Holly was already more than just an emerging force in rock and roll, despite being on the scene for just 18 months before his death. With all of his success in music, he had already set his sights on a broader career. He was taking acting lessons and wanted to move into film. At the same time, he was learning piano and flamenco guitar. He had recorded so much before he died that his record label was able to release albums and singles for the next 10 years. The most famous of all Buddy Holly songs is That'll Be the Day. In 1986, he was a member of the first class of those inducted into the new Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Here are a few more accolades for Buddy Holly. Encyclopedia Britannica stated that Holly produced some of the most distinctive and influential work in rock music. AllMusic defined him as the single most influential creative force in early rock and roll. Rolling Stone ranked him as number 13 on its list of 100 greatest artists. The Daily Telegraph called him a pioneer and revolutionary, a multidimensional talent who co-wrote and performed songs that remained as fresh and potent today. In 2023, Rolling Stone ranked Holly at number 174 on its list of the top 200 greatest singers of all time. His legacy, however, is marred by ongoing legal troubles over the use of his name, image, likeness, intellectual property, royalties, and more. That kind of thing is standard stuff today, but Buddy Holly was a trendsetter in more than one way, this being one of them. You can look up Buddy Holly's Law for more about this, but it was said that he agreed to do the Winter Dance Party tour because he was bankrupt. Something else that Buddy Holly is known for, little known for, I should say. It's because of the way Buddy's family was notified, or rather, wasn't notified of his death. His wife learned of the crash on the TV news, and his mother first heard on the radio. It's been said that Holly's wife, Maria Santiago, was so shocked that she miscarried her baby almost immediately upon hearing the news. It was the next day, actually. Since that time, the policy is that officials will notify family or next of kin before releasing the names to the media. I couldn't find much of anything on this, giving it kind of an urban legend vibe. I would think, though, that if something was policy, as what I read indicated, that I would be able to find the policy somewhere online. I could not. And speaking of legacy, how could I not include mention of the song American Pie by Don McLean? I'd heard this song as a teenager many times, hundreds of times maybe, before I learned its true meaning when I was an adult. This was a number one song for 4 weeks in the United States, beginning in January of 1972. It also topped the charts in Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, while reaching number two in many others. The repeated phrase in the song, "The Day the Music Died," is a reference to the plane crash in that Iowa field in 1959. It is because of this song that the phrase became a popular name for the crash itself. There are lots of meanings in this song, some deep, some less so, but it's been said that the name of the song, American Pie, comes from the name of the Beechcraft Bonanza that carried these young men to their deaths. This is so not true that in 2015, when McLean explained many of the hidden meanings, and then again in a 2022 documentary, that this theory was never even mentioned. Additionally, there is no reference to the Bonanza ever having any name, let alone American Pie. Not in the CAB report or anywhere that I could find in any of my research. We're nearing the end of this episode, but I teased a couple of things at the top of this that I have yet to bring full circle. A gunshot in the cabin of the Bonanza and an exhumation. There was a rumor that the reason for the crash was a gunshot in the cabin of the Bonanza, that the pilot, Peterson, had been shot and killed. Since none of the other three were pilots and none of my research indicated that any of them had ever taken any flight training, I can only imagine that such a thing would have had to have been a terrible accident. I mean, who shoots their pilot? However, there was a gun found near the crash site a couple of months after the crash, after the snow had melted, and it fueled enough rumor over the years that the Big Bopper's son, J. Perry Richardson Jr., continued to be bothered about it. In 2007, when his father's body was being moved to a more suitable location that could also include a bronze statue of the musician, the son thought that since the body was being moved anyway, let's have the body re-examined by a coroner. I'm just following the research here. One article said it was the pilot, Peterson, who was shot. Yet it was Richardson, aka the Big Bopper, who was exhumed and re-examined. Did this article perhaps get the names Peterson and Richardson confused? I don't know, but Richardson Jr. was now asking the coroner to look specifically for a hole resulting from the gunshot or any remains of the bullet. The coroner found nothing of the sort. Then, in 2015, a retired pilot from America requested that the NTSB reopen the investigation, citing that he felt there was a mechanical failure with the so-called rudder vader of the Bonanza, which, under the right conditions, including icing, could be subject to failure. He was arguing that the plane crashed due to mechanical failure, not pilot error. He was also concerned with improper weight distribution of the personnel and luggage on board. We talked about this earlier with my friend Len, who mentioned that this was indeed a sensitivity of the Bonanza. The NTSB declined to reopen the investigation. Let's wrap up this unfortunate and historic crash with a look at the findings of the CAB report. But really, there are no surprises here. Despite the rumors of a gunshot in the cabin, there is no smoking gun revealed in the report. On the first page, the report stated, quote, "This accident, like so many before it, was caused by the pilot's decision to undertake flight in which the likelihood of encountering instrument conditions existed in the mistaken belief that he could cope with en route instrument weather conditions without having the necessary familiarization with instruments in the aircraft and without being properly certified to fly solely by instrument," unquote. The next many pages were devoted to the step-by-step, minute-by-minute detail of the crash, including the many engine, radio, and control settings. The plane was fully complemented with instruments for IFR flying and autopilot control. The plane was properly maintained, certified, and inspected. The report explained how the Sperry F3 provided a reverse image and one that the pilot was not accustomed to using. It also noted that the flying service, Dwyer Flying Service, was properly certified to fly passengers for hire in accordance with visual flight rules day and night. The report concluded with this. The board determines that the probable cause of this accident was the pilot's unwise decision to embark on a flight which would necessitate flying solely on instruments when he was not properly certified or qualified to do so. Contributing factors were serious deficiencies in the weather briefing and the pilot's unfamiliarity with the instrument which determines the attitude of the aircraft. The report did not mention the passengers by name, issues related to weight imbalance, or issues that may have been brought about by icing conditions affecting the airplane. That's all for this time on Radar Contact Lost, the podcast. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to learn more about this crash, there's quite a bit of information online, including a PDF of the CAB aircraft accident report. Just search Buddy Holly and you'll be occupied for as long as you want to be occupied. If you have Amazon Alexa and would like to hear some Buddy Holly music, just say, "Alexa, play Buddy Holly and similar artists." I'd like to thank the team here at Radar Contact Lost. On the weather side, we have meteorologist Chris Hebert from Storm Geo and forensic meteorologist Joe Spain from Risk Consulting. On the air traffic control side, we have former U.S. Air Force and FAA controllers Cindy and Michael Hintz and Tony Gorham. On the piloting side, we have former U.S. Air Force and retired FedEx Captain Michelle Acorn and FedEx First Officer Larry Gregory. This series is researched, written, edited, and produced by me. If you liked this episode, please give a like and leave a review and tell your friends. Likes and reviews help other podcast listeners find this podcast. On Instagram, follow at Radar Contact Lost Podcast. I provide behind the scenes, time schedules, interesting factoids, and more. We're also on YouTube. If you'd like to reach out, send an email to rclpodcast1@gmail.com. That's rclpodcast1@gmail.com. With each new episode of Radar Contact Lost, I will bring you interesting but tragic stories of plane crashes from across the United States and from around the world. When these crashes involve the weather as a possible cause or as a contributing factor, I rely on my 40-year career as an Air Force, broadcast, and commercial meteorologist with a specialty of aviation meteorology to explain what happened and why. I'll also lean on my experts in meteorology, air traffic control, and piloting to peel back the curtain to take a closer look at what really happened. Lastly, let me thank you, the listeners. Radar Contact Lost has now been downloaded in 36 countries. Thank you. That's 4 more countries that have joined the podcast since the last episode. That's really great. And I'm very happy to bring these stories to you, to all of you who have a love of weather, aviation, and history, just like me. Thanks for climbing aboard and settling in for the latest from the Radar Contact Lost team. I'm Dave Gorham.